From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Go on, Simon Boy, thank you.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Ah, well, the things you learn when you do a job like this. Sandy Edwards is a healer, and she instigated a trial, a natural healing trial at the University of Birmingham, a hospital in Birmingham, right? Funded by the National Lottery. And it involved 200 hospital patients with long-standing illnesses. This happened only a few years ago, and there is a book about it, written by Sandy Edwards, called Healing in a Hospital: Scientific Evidence That Spiritual Healing Improves Health. I can't wait to catch up with Sandy in the second hour. She'll be on to talk about that. Before that, the clinical hypnotherapist and the stage performer Jonathan Royal will be on the programme. He was also involved in Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Very, very good documentary about mind control. Jonathan will be on this hour and we'll talk about compliance. Why people comply. We will talk about the science of compliance with the Jonathan Royal. That's Tuesday's programme, October 13th, with me, the BPG. How you doing? You all right? There you are. Jump in there on Twitter and have your say. All right, busy old day today. Recorded Glitch in the Code with Richard Willett. The podcast that's on Iconic. Lovely fella, Richard, filmmaker. And he invited me to have a natter with him, so I did that. So look out for that. Look out for that. All righty, let's have a look at what's been happening then. Matt Hancock, Health Secretary, goon, took to his feet in the Commons today to basically say most of what Boris Johnson said yesterday about the new three-tier system. And Liverpool, sadly for people in Liverpool, they'll be in Tier 3 on Wednesday, which will destroy the hospitality business, their leisure. Most of them won't survive. They've been on telly and radio, men and women running gyms, running bars. Devastated, God love them. Heartbreaking stuff. In the Commons today, Matt Hancock, safe in the knowledge that nobody would challenge him, he decided that he would take on the scientists who signed the Great Barrington Declaration. He's a big hero, is Matt Hancock. He's a big tough guy. Now, the Barrington Declaration scientists are basically calling for herd immunity to release Wodger, release Wadowick, release everybody, release the 99.99% of us who are not vulnerable to this thing, and to protect the people who are. That's the gist of it. So Matt Hancock, the little worm that he is, putrid man, he hasn't met any of these women and men, of course, but he will ridicule them from the sanctity of Parliament, where, of course, they can't defend themselves or obliterate him with scientific fact. Here is Matt Hancock today.
And I want to take this argument head on, because on the substance, the Great Barrington Declaration is underpinned by two central claims, and both are emphatically false. First, it says that if enough people get COVID, we will reach herd immunity. This is not true. Many infectious diseases never reach herd immunity, like measles and malaria and AIDS and flu. And with increasing evidence of reinfection, we should have no confidence that we would ever reach herd immunity to COVID, even if everyone caught it. Herd immunity is a flawed goal without a vaccine, even if we could get to it, which we can't.
I've heard that there's a stink of talcum powder off of Matt Hancock. People who've worked in the media for years have said to me, Richie, it's a strange thing. Whenever you're around Matt Hancock, there's a smell of talcum powder. Now, I know why this is, and that is because when Matt Hancock isn't being seen on television, he's wearing a rubber suit and a rubber hood, and he's being led around by a collar and chain. Because Matt Hancock is a bitch. That's what he is. He is. This isn't me being crass now and silly. And Matt's whoremasters, they spend their days at the World Health Organization and Oxford and Cambridge and AstraZeneca and GSK. Those are his masters. He's a lapdog. That's why he smells of talcum powder. He wears a rubber bondage suit. And his paymasters, because he's a nobody, Hancock, They've basically been turning natural law on its head for years, aided and abetted by the media, but also, laterally, by Google. You see, Google has purged thousands and thousands of articles and papers going back years, basically that prove that naturally acquired immunity through getting the virus is far better than injecting us with a toxic tidal wave of foul shit and pus, which nobody really knows the consequences of. We don't. Now, because the vast, vast majority of people, 99%, won't get seriously ill if they brush up against COVID, let them get it. Let them get it. While spending serious money on a supplement program, vitamin D3, right? Properly ventilating care homes, getting residents out and about as much as you can. All of this could be done, but it isn't about the virus. Yes. Now, I never speak in fact, unless I'm speaking in fact. I must have told you a million times over the years. Conjecture. I'm not offering an opinion. I'm giving you the facts. There has been a purging, and I've talked about this for years on the radio show, of academic articles, peer-reviewed, not just on the subject of herd immunity, but on every subject. By who? By the WHO. And by the big pharmaceutical companies and Google and Yahoo and all the rest of them. This is knowledge. Let people get it. They'll build up a herd immunity and it'll be better for everybody. Why? Well, because your body will be in a much better place if it has fought off the virus itself, if it has done it itself naturally. It'll build up antibodies then in your blood. All right. But this isn't about the virus. Here's more from Matt Hancock taking on the great Barrington Declaration scientists, but not affording them the opportunity to debate him or Tweedledum and Tweedledee, the Chuckle Brothers, Whitty and Hancock. Whitty and Valance, I should say. Here's the second part of his attempted takedown of the great Barrington scientists.
The second central claim is that we can segregate the old and the vulnerable on our way to herd immunity. This is simply not possible. As the medical director of the NHS said yesterday, we cannot somehow fence off the elderly and the vulnerable from risk while everyone else returns to normal. It's neither conscionable nor practicable. Not when so many people live in intergenerational homes, when older people need carers who, of course, themselves live in the community, and not when young people can suffer the debilitating impact of long COVID.
Long COVID. We'll come back to that in a minute.
Whenever we've seen cases among young people rise sharply, we then see cases among the over 60s rise inevitably thereafter. And we are not the kind of country that abandons our vulnerable or just locks them up.
But you are, you lying bastard. You are. You locked old people into hermetically sealed care homes. And then you took people out of hospital. You didn't test them. They could have had anything. And you sent them in to those hermetically sealed care homes. You lying bastard. You are the very sort of person who would lock people up and abandon them. And the great Barrington scientists are not suggesting that. Journalists like me who have to admit that are not medically qualified. I'm not. But I'm not advocating. I am not advocating locking old people up either. I'm advocating vitamin D3 to beat Jesus out of them every winter. But why do we not do that? Because vitamin D3 is cheap. It doesn't earn any money for anybody. It's better that we vaccinate senior citizens and that we vaccinate children with that great, great lie. Let's vaccinate kids so that they don't give flu to granny. It's a massive lie. If we vitamin D3'd the bejesus, and that is a technical term, by the way, that is a scientific term, vitamin D3'd the bejesus out of people. Ventilated care homes properly. Care homes are not all ventilated properly. I'm sure some of them are. Get old people out in the fresh air. Jesus, wrap them up. There are such things as jackets and coats and scarves and hats and earmuffs and gloves. Get them out. That's how you do. You don't abandon them. Jesus wept. What else does he say, this pimp?
If we let this virus...
No, he's not a pimp, he's a bitch.
...virus continue unchecked, the loss of life would be simply too great to contemplate. And we know it would put our NHS at risk, as my honourable friends have just said. Both, we know this, both because...
This protect the NHS shit. What about the NHS protecting us? That's how it's supposed to work. I mean, this is real inverted stuff, this, isn't it? This is real screwing with people's brains. Protect the NHS? But isn't the NHS supposed to protect us? I don't know, I think I heard that somewhere. And isn't it supposed to do that because you tax the ever-living Jesus out of us? We pay for it. So aren't we entitled to use it when we need it? Without being told to stay away from it. Because we need to keep the beds open for COVID patients. Insane. Everything is insane, you see. Designed to be such. So people's minds are spinning all the time. They don't know whether they're coming or going, you know.
Because of what happened in March and because of what is happening right now. We've already heard from the heads of the Academy of Royal Colleges and the Royal College of Emergency Medicine.
Yeah. Jesus wept. Shut up. Hancock there. Do you know what he tweeted last night? He tweeted, our strategy is to suppress the virus, support education, the economy and the NHS until a vaccine can keep us safe. That's what it's all about. Some laugh today. Some laugh. The London Mayor, Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, should be the Mayor of Munchkinland. I crap bigger than Sadiq Khan. He's a ridiculous little dude. This geezer wants a national lockdown for 3 weeks. A circuit breaker, as they have begun to call it. Yeah, if the economy is on its back, let's knife it in the throat now, says Sadiq Khan.
Sage is saying, and by the way, these are experts appointed by the government. They're not my experts. They're government-appointed experts. Sage is saying the most effective way to slow down the spread of the virus and to get a grip with it is a short 2-week circuit breaker across the country. And by the way, doing that not simply stops the spread of the virus, but also avoids months and months and months of restrictions in tier 1, 2, or 3. And by the way, at the moment, we know our businesses are being hammered because of a COVID-19 consequences without proper financial support. Can you imagine them in 4 or 5 months' time with these restrictions? So I know it sounds tough having two, three weeks of a really strict regime, but that 2, 3 weeks will ameliorate months and months of us dealing with the health consequences and the economic consequences as well.
Madman, the mayor of Londonistan. That's what the far right calls it. Londonistan always makes me chuckle. The Welsh Forest Minister is Mark Drakeford. He's the Taffy's Jimmy Cranky, effectively. He's the first minister of the Valleys. He looked at the nut job that is Matt Hancock and said, I'll see your lunacy and I will raise it. First Minister of Wales, Mark Drakeford. This is good.
North Wales police cannot stop someone and turn them back simply because they're not following guidance. We need rules that prevent people from high incidence areas coming into Wales to low incidence areas. The Prime Minister needs to act. He has the power. He has the authority. What he lacks is the willingness.
Yeah.
He needs to find that.
Yeah, this guy wants people in England to be banned from travelling to Wales if their own town or area is in a high tier alert. So if you're in level 2 or 3. And he wants this change to be made in the law so that the police can arrest people for driving to Wales. Unbelievable. And of course, this is where health passports on your phone and devices come in. You can't go to Cardiff for the wedding. Turn back! Because there are a higher number of cases than usual in Salford. Get back up the motorway, you big, ignorant, baldy bollocks of a gammon. Yes, officer. Fair enough. Your phone will give you away. Your phone will hang you out to dry. That big, baldy prick is from... Well, he's from Salford. Send him back. Dr. Lawrence Gurlis is a well-known GP. He told Talk Radio's Mike Graham this morning that the media are taking a perverse delight in fear porn. Dr. Lawrence Gurlis.
I still think there is some perverse enjoyment that certain parts of media have in making this look worse than it
yeah.
is. And I still can't work out the motivation for
no,
some reason.
I think they're just...
I can't work out the motivation, he said. They're getting paid to. That's their job, is to exaggerate, amplify, terrify, terrorise the nation. Anyway, Mike Graham, then, the presenter, he has something very interesting to say.
Just do. I think they've just got lonely, desperate, ghastly lives, some of these people, because I know a lot of journalists and most of them are psychopaths.
Most of them are psychopaths, the journalists that Mike Graham knows. This isn't tongue-in-cheek. He isn't joking.
And most of them are actually very lonely people. They can't get on with anyone. So I imagine what they actually enjoy doing is to actually kind of, you know, frighten everyone because they become obsessed. I mean, look at Robert Peston. Yeah. Look at Beth Rigby. Look at Laura Kunzberg. I mean, would you want to sit with any of those people on a long train journey?
Yeah, I would. I'd love to spend time in a carriage with Laura Kunzberg, Beth Rigby and Robert Peston. I'd have plenty of fun with them on a long train journey. 18 minutes past the hour. Welsh First Minister demanding travel bans. Sadiq Khan demanding a 2 to 3 week national lockdown. There's no opposition to it anywhere. None. It's a load of monumental bollocks. All of it. It really is. The whole thing has fallen apart. You know, the Edinburgh study has destroyed it. The Great Barrington Declaration, scientists have annihilated this. The need for this lockdown. We know what's going on. And it has fallen apart. And this is why the government, I think anyway, has introduced its aces in the hole. They've got two aces to play. One of them is long COVID, which makes me laugh, and reinfection. Long COVID. Let's deal with long COVID for 30 seconds.
Matt Hancock's long COVID.
Yeah, the Richie Allen production crew were up all night making that jingle. I made it, by the way. It's garbage, right? Okay. Long COVID is the notion that young folks don't just brush COVID, but in fact, they end up with very debilitating, very serious illnesses, long-term illnesses like fatigue and chronic illnesses and heart problems. There's no evidence for any of this. None. There's been no proper study done. It's just a lie. But it's one of their ace cards. Because when you say, listen, your whole story is falling apart. Only 82-year-old people die of COVID, really. Doesn't do any harm to most of the population. They introduce the lie of long COVID. So that's one ace card. Second ace card is this reinfection. We are seeing evidence, they are saying, that people can get COVID again. And again, and again, and again, and again. Here's the BBC today.
A man in the United States has caught COVID twice, with doctors reporting the second infection being more dangerous than the first. The 25-year-old from Nevada needed hospital treatment after his lungs couldn't get enough oxygen into his body. Our health correspondent, Anna Collinson, explains that this case is in the minority. But
it is in the minority now.
But it's still interesting for the scientific community.
It's still interesting. The BBC should not cover this because this has not been peer-reviewed. Basically, some random guy from Nevada, could be anybody, could be, I don't know, little Jimmy Malone in Nevada, believes that he's had COVID twice. Right? So let's make a big news story out of it, even though we don't have any idea if that is common enough to even talk about. But hey, we're the BBC. We're part of the fear porn. So let's hear from the BBC reporter in the US about the bloke that got COVID twice. Many years ago, dear listener, this is true. Many, many, many years ago. I come from a place called Waterford City. And I used to go on trips with my uncle many, many years ago. He was a musician. And I would go to hotels in rural areas now. Rural areas, right? Out of the city, out of the town. And I can remember a time when you would buy a ticket to go and see the man who met John Wayne. Honest to God, I'm not making it up. Village Hall, come and meet the guy who met John Wayne. John Wayne made a film in Ireland years ago, very famous film, The Quiet Man. Come and meet the man who met John Wayne. That's how it was. This is what this news roundup is like. Let's hear about the bloke from Nevada who might have got COVID twice. You couldn't make this shit up.
This case is about a 25-year-old man, so he's young. He's from the US state of Nevada. And in April, he started experiencing some symptoms. Cough, fever, headache, that kind of thing. And he was tested for coronavirus and he got a positive result. Mm-hmm. Now, those symptoms then went away and he was then tested two more times and got a negative result. But then at the end of the May, he started experiencing the same symptoms again, though this time those symptoms were worse. So on top of the headache, the cough, he started experiencing shortness of breath and had to be hospitalised with oxygen support.
Wow.
Because his lungs were struggling to pump that vital oxygen around his body.
Oh, well, this is proof then. definitive proof that you can get COVID again and again and again.
Now, in early June, he once again tested positive for coronavirus. So that's twice in a matter of months. Now, this man was young. He had no underlying health conditions or immune disorders, and he's since recovered. But what's significant about his case is it suggests previous exposure to COVID-19 does not necessarily guarantee immunity.
That's outrageous. They're talking about one guy. That is outrageous. One guy out of a population of 7 billion people. 7.5 billion. The guy was sick and then he wasn't sick and then he tested negative and negative again and then he tested positive again and he had a bit of shortness of breath. It suggests, says the reporter, that getting COVID once is no guarantee that you won't get it again. Mad stuff. Listen, we better just listen to Margaret Harris. Remember Margaret? We should give up, I think. Let's give up. Let's just give up and just accept this.
We have to learn the new dance, the coronavirus dance, to protect ourselves.
Yeah, learn the coronavirus dance and let's just wait for the vaccine, for the cavalry. Let's wait for the vaccine and accept that, well, we can't do any more than that, right? The Richie Allen Radio Show is live from Salford in Greater Manchester. My name is Richie Allen. Great to be with you. Jonathan Royal is next. This is the last of the famous international playboys from Morrissey on your Richie Allen Radio Show, Tuesday's edition. It is the 13th of October and it's dark. The old stretch in the evenings is gone. Why are people so compliant? Why? Why? Knowing what their governments have done in the last 15 to 20 years alone, you don't even have to go back any further than that. The Libya intervention, right? Iraq, the lies about the Iraq war. I could be here all day. Why are people so compliant? Why do they take these instructions and follow them? No better man to ask than my first guest this hour. He is a clinical hypnotherapist and a stage hypnotist. He was first introduced to me because of the excellent documentary Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, which he presented. And you can find that online. It's on YouTube, Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. I really recommend you check it out. Let's welcome back to the programme, Jonathan Royal. You can follow him on Twitter. Please do. It's at Royal Hypnotist there. Jonathan, thanks for taking the time out to speak to us, mate. How are you?
I'm good, Rich. How are you?
I'm great, and it was short notice, pal, so thanks for coming on. In fact,
it's crazy times.
Now, you, when we talk about acquiescence and compliance, I would imagine that you're not as surprised, maybe, as I am, that people are blindly, in many cases, going along with these contradictory and arbitrary instructions coming from their government.
There's only one thing that surprises me at the minute, and this is a bit of positive hope for everyone. What actually is surprising me is the large number of people who are actually waking up and realising. But sadly, that is still the tiny, tiny, tiny minority. We still need to get that message out there because, you know, we're fighting against people having been conditioned from the day they were born. That's the problem. Part of their conscious mind is probably saying to them, this doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. You know, if something's so dangerous that we need to close down pubs and restaurants, say, in the top category of places, then why don't we close them with immediate effect now rather than wait till Wednesday, which is what's happening with Liverpool? It doesn't make sense. Anyone with a functioning brain cell can see that doesn't make sense. The same as when we had, you know, lockdown earlier in the year. Yeah, we're going to close everything from this day. No, hang on a minute. Do it immediately. If it's that dangerous, if you've got genuine evidence of danger, normal risk assessment for any industry, health and safety risk assessment training, is if you identify a risk and there is a way to safely mitigate that risk, minimise it as much as possible, that you do it in the quickest, safest way possible. You don't go in 2 weeks' time, you're going to have to start wearing masks.
Yeah.
Because if you've got evidence saying you're going to need masks, then surely that evidence exists now. So therefore, by not getting us to do it now, you are either lying to us or putting us at risk. Now, personally, I think it's lying to us, the majority of it. But that's not the point. You know, the truth is, I think they do it on purpose. because by making people actually think that doesn't make sense, that makes people become confused. And they will be split into a couple of categories of people generally. The category of people who, like many of your listeners, Richie, are already waking up or have woken up massively and already know what a ridiculous world we live in. It will go, they're up to something here. But sadly still, the majority of people fall into the other category, which is, we know something's not quite right, but these are the people in power. They must have our best interest at heart, because they're still subject, sadly, the vast majority of the population, and that's where we can all help out, you know, trying to wake people up, to the conditioning they've got from birth, going to nursery, going to school, being conditioned into learning what they're taught by authority figures, memorizing it, recalling it in exams and getting rewarded for recalling what the authority figure told them. You're not really learning stuff at school. It's an indoctrination system to teach you to obey authority figures. And with the exception of when people get bullied at school, obviously that happens to some people. Sadly, it happened to me. But generally speaking, the classroom is engineered to be relatively safe, or at least it used to be. I hear stories these days of chairs getting chucked around and all manner of nonsense now that teachers are not allowed to give people a clip around the ear. But generally speaking, everything from the day you're born, whether it's nursery, school, summer clubs, literally everything, and then you go to work, everything is geared to condition people at a deep subconscious, unconscious level that authority figures either have to be trusted or have to be feared or have to be obeyed, because if you don't obey them, then there are repercussions.
The obedience thing. And yeah. I should give another mention of the documentary that we first spoke about when you first came on, Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. Do check it out, folks, because Jonathan gets into this in great detail.
We demonstrate all those different areas of life. It's everything. It's your schooling, the way it's structured. It's your job, the hierarchy of social systems. You know, you might not realise it, but even going to something like, I won't give them, no, that'd be publicity, wouldn't it? If you're going to a weight management group, there are various names of them. Even they are structured to make you feel a sense of self-blame, shame, guilt and regret if you haven't managed to lose weight, say, by the next meeting. And you're judged then by the people around you. So to feel accepted or special, or to feel good about yourself, you have to lose, even if it's only a pound, and so that then people will give you a round of applause, a pat on the back, and make you feel worthwhile. Well, so that same principle of people feeling bad and being inflicted with feelings of guilt, shame, blame and regret, and anyone involved, no offence to anyone who is, who does believe in an invisible God or a deity, but Catholic Church is a prime example of instilling self-blame, shame, guilt and regret into people, and then absolving them of it through confession and stuff to make them reliant on that ability to let go of that apparent self-blame, shame, guilt and regret, which, you know, if they had people's best interest at heart in religion, they'd empower the person to realise that heaven and hell are within yourself. It's your own creation. It's a state of mind. It's the same as politics. If we actually had any say in anything, they wouldn't let us vote on it. Simple as that.
Let me ask you this, Jonathan. Let me ask you this, because I want to stay with this. When you talk about cradle-to-grave programming to accept authority figures, to accept their presence, to accept their necessity, and to accept that they have our best interests in heart, can you contemplate, have you contemplated, that maybe that programming was all about a day of reckoning, like what we are currently witnessing now? Because I'm struggling with that. Have we been led into the state of mind, the collective state of mind of obedience, because it was part of some plan further down the line you know, in order to prevent us from, or try to prevent us from, rising up against it.
Definitely. And my reasoning for that is this. Now, at the time that all this started, the plan may not have been as fully formed as it has been in the past few decades. But the thing is this. If you go back decades and decades and decades, there was a time when there was no education system. Okay, people would go to their priest and they would ask, you know, if they got a letter from someone in authority, they'd go to a priest to get it read to them, or and then to reply to it and stuff. So there was a dependence upon the authority figure there. But over time, some people did start to arguably wake up and question, well, why not teach us how to read? And that was the first stage of the education system coming into place. And as they gave them a bit, people demanded more. So on the one hand, to keep people under control so that it doesn't become a mass riot of why won't you teach us, they leave it as long as they can, and then they had to bring in education, and over time people demanded more. But then after a while, and that while can be years and years, they can start to take it away again without people often without people realizing. And a prime example of that is I spoke to a lot of teachers over the past few years who have actually left England and gone to other countries to work privately because nothing to do with money, just because they couldn't bring themselves to continue working in the environment as it is, where the syllabus is always being changed at the last minute, that, you know, they're not telling teachers what needs to be taught until the very last minute, they're changing things, and they're dumbing things down. And that's a purposeful thing. So, yeah, you know, throughout history, you've only got to look. I know these get brought up by everyone, but you know, if you read 1984, George Orwell, Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, the kind of world they predicted in their apparently fictional works, that was based on the information they had then. Prior to that, if you go back and look at another apparently fictional work, and I say apparently because, you know, I accept it as that it was a forgery when it was found, when it was released. I want everyone to realize that. But nonetheless, the simple fact is forgery and not claiming, you know, not being what it claimed to be or not, in 1903, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion document, which you can find on the internet freely to look at, was published in 1903. Even people who say it's a forgery agree that it existed in 1903. So in that context only, this document written in 1903, read it and you see laid out a plan in 1903, which has either already occurred as they said it would occur, or is occurring, the final bits occurring, unfolding around us right now. To such a degree that can that just be coincidence? Well, if it's coincidence, I'm a Chinaman. Chinese.
You'll know this. My Jewish mates, they get properly cheesed off when anybody, not cheesed off with you, but when anybody brings up the protocols, because they say that unequivocally it was a forgery. And
yeah, fine, it's a forgery.
But no, they say the reason.
That's what being written no, by
no,
Jewish
I know
people.
That. I know that. But they say the reason they find it so repulsive is because it suggests that there is an innate desire amongst Jewish people to control events and to control the world, and they find that repugnant.
Isn't.
Yeah, and I don't believe that personally, and I don't think you do.
My research is that the vast, vast, vast majority of Jewish people are probably not even aware of the nefarious intent and the horrible things that a teeny few people who are Jewish, but a massive amount of the people, probably the majority, are not Jewish. It's not about what colour, race or creed or religion.
Yeah, of course.
There's people from all colours, races, creeds, religions, elements of the world that are part of the so-called Illuminati, that ridiculous word, part of the control system. It's not, it isn't a Jewish conspiracy. Anyone who says that is anti-Semitic, is being ridiculous. But saying that there are some people who are Jewish, just as there are some people who are English, there are some that are French, there are some that, every nationality in the world, race, colour and creed, there's elements from all that make up the powers that be, so to speak, the people at the top of the agenda, the people who really pull the strings in the secret societies, as we cover in Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis, the people who truly fund the likes of Bill Gates, because Bill Gates is held up as this big multi-billionaire philanthropist, allegedly. But, you know, he isn't top of the tree. It's the people hidden in the shadows.
Yeah. And you know what, Jonathan? I spent years talking about the influence of families like Warburg, Rothschild, Oppenheimer. Mm. And like you, I won't allow anybody gaslight me. These families have unimaginable influence on global events beyond the scope of most people's imagination. But what I struggled for years to comprehend was the fact that these families were considered to be Jewish families. I don't believe they are Jewish families. They might say they are. They might claim to be Jewish, but they're not. And Jewish people, like everybody else, and Jews in England and Ireland, around the world, are as much under the jackboot of this thing that we're under now as anybody else is, as you've pointed out. So it's a strange one. I don't know what I think of the protocols. I know friends of mine, and one particular friend of mine, has written about it. I don't know what to make of it, to be honest.
Only thing, it doesn't matter what you make of it in that context.
Because you think it's uncannily accurate. You think it's
the
accurate.
The one thing that nobody disagrees with is there's a proof it existed in 1903.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter who wrote it. The point is somebody wrote it and the contents have occurred or are quite clearly elements of what's needed to occur have occurred in order that the rest can occur as things go on. You know, in the same way as if you look at the, if you go searching on Google for the Rockefeller PDF from 2010, which is, if you use the keyword lockstep with it, that was put out in 2010, and it's got in there what it details, the lockstep section about how to control society.
Yeah.
We're seeing that going on right now.
Right now, and that's why it is fascinating. It did exist, whomever wrote it. And anybody who knows anything about it will know that Henry Ford was a big believer in it. But again, Jewish scholars will say Henry Ford was a notorious anti-Semite. So look, let me just read this. This is interesting, because you have these families. You have the Rockefeller family. Obviously, you have the banking families we mentioned. Spiro has just sent me this. Now, I was aware of this because I've seen this quote several times before. Rockefeller wrote an autobiography back in 2002, and there is a quote in it, and it is genuine. He says, "Some even believe we, the Rockefellers presumably, are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it." Rockefeller did write that. There's no doubt about that. So it's all there, isn't it? I mean, there's no denying any of this stuff. It's in the public domain.
All the pieces of the jigsaw are hidden in plain sight. Well, that's the thing. They're getting more and more blatant now, you see. If you watch closely the news in recent times, several times they've talked about the behavioural control unit, or as its nickname, the Nudge Unit in London.
Yeah.
This is a unit that's set up to study the best way to influence the general public to think what they want you to think, to do what they want you to do. A prime example being, they will have realised that with this whole mask wearing thing, and I'm not going to go into the elements of the evidence out there that it can be harmful for you to wear a mask and all this, that, the other. I'm just talking from the psychology here. They wanted people to wear masks. And so they put the emphasis on putting stories out into the media that people who've not got a provable valid medical reason not to wear a mask should be, you know, reported. The police should be pulled in. They should be fined. That people should, you know, name and shame them. In other words, it was about turning the majority of the population who were compliant, because they still believe in, you know, the authority figure, the conditioned from birth we spoke about before, turning them against everyone else to make them go, hey, get a mask on. Why haven't you got a mask on? So that the other people who, all right, at one extreme, it doesn't matter what happens. There's people who walk up enough and stand up for themselves. Great. But then there's that midsection where there's people trying to wake up, trying to do their own thing. But then if they suddenly got the majority of the populace going, oh, you selfish bugger, get a mask on. You're going to kill people.
Yeah.
It's instilling into people. It's legalized bullying. They're encouraging people effectively to instill blame, shame, guilt and regret into people.
And I get anecdotal evidence of this every day, Jonathan. Let me just remind our listeners, we are joined today by Jonathan Royal. And folks, look up the protocols of the Elders of Zion yourself. Don't take my synopsis of it or my opinion of it. Make your own opinion of it. You know, as Jonathan quite rightly says, it was out there in the early part of the 20th century. Ford printed it. It's been claimed to be a forgery. There are a lot of people who say that it isn't. My genuine Jewish mates always get pissed off when it's mentioned, because they say, look, it's absolutely anti-Semitism. It was out there to create the idea that Jews were, as a group, determined to control the planet by themselves.
I think
Jews.
I actually, deep down, to be honest, my own conclusion is that that was part of the plan with the original document. So in the context of the way it was purported to be, I'd say, yeah, it's a forgery. And that part of the plan was to make it look like that there was some kind of Jewish conspiracy, so that it would further deflect from the real people behind the scenes.
See, that's a brilliant thing. And they've been doing that for years, haven't they?
Yeah, and also so it would divide and conquer.
Because Jewish folks, most of them go to the synagogue on a Saturday and they come home and they do their thing and they go to work, they come home, they spend their time with their family at weekends. And like, I know a lot of Jewish people who don't get offended at all by any of this. They say, I couldn't care less, Richie. You know, you'll always have people out there who blame the Jews for absolutely everything. And I have other Jewish contacts, people I know, and they're very interested in these families that we talk about. You know, Dean Henderson has written about them, the four horsemen of the apocalypse, these banking families who, you know, I always believed that these families hid behind this claim of Jewishness to basically avoid, or not to avoid, but to try and deflect real analysis or investigation of what they're actually up to. Because once you mention Rothschild, it's immediate, well, you've got to be anti-Semitic, you've got to be racist. But that's not fair. You should be able to examine what the Rothschild family has been up to forever without being accused of anti-Semitism. I would totally agree with that.
Forget, there's other banking families who are not Jewish.
Yeah. It's got nothing to do with Jewishness. It's unimaginably evil. And many of these families are not Jewish. They don't go to the synagogue. In fact, we know from some of the men and women we've met over the years, me and you, Jonathan, we know that these people are Luciferian. They love this stuff. They love it. Look at some of these Rothschild balls and gatherings and that, what is it, that goat's head, all that demonic, satanic stuff going on there.
Imagery everywhere. Yeah. And the reason they use imagery is because they understand that imagery, symbolism, symbols, visual imagery is the language of the unconscious, subconscious mind. Yeah. That is why they embed it into pop videos, TV shows and such like. We cover this in Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis to a small degree. It's because, you know, a really good example of symbolism is, look at the opening ceremony of the last Olympics. Somebody with a giant head on the head, a giant, you know, papier-mâché head in a hospital bed that looks just like Boris Johnson.
Crazy, isn't it? I can't explain that, Jonathan.
The ceremony is basically the corona predicted programming.
Is this 2012, the opening ceremony of 2012?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you alerted me to that, you did, and I watched it. And I really am a child sometimes. I watched it and I cried laughing. And then I talked about it on the show. This is maybe last year. not last year, last April or maybe even late March. I just couldn't believe what I was watching, because it is. You can't say that it isn't connected. It must be.
It's just mental. It's completely, utterly mental. These things, either they do this on purpose, and the logic for doing things like that on purpose is what they call predictive programming, because you see it, you're consciously not aware of what their agenda is, but because of all this weird visual imagery that doesn't really make much sense, your unconscious mind is always paying attention and stores this imagery. So it's kind of there in the filing banks of your personal laptop computer.
Yeah.
So that when something relevant to that, because as human beings, we pattern match. And what I mean by that is...
Pattern match. What's that? Pattern match.
Yeah, an example of pattern matching is if you, say, earlier in life had been mugged by somebody with long black hair, and you're walking down the street now as an adult, the chances are if you see somebody coming up towards you with long black hair, your unconscious mind works in a matter of milliseconds. And it's gone through the filing cabinet of your unconscious mind. Is person with long black hair safe or dangerous? And the memory that you've got stored is one of being mugged by somebody with long black hair. So you're more likely to be cautious or panicky of someone who looks similar. Whereas when you've got associations to most people that are positive, we generally seem relaxed. So your mind, your unconscious, looks for a pattern and tries to find a match to something it's previously experienced as reality in life before. But the trouble is your unconscious mind doesn't know the difference between something it's imagined and something that genuinely took place. And that's why in my work as a hypnotherapist, I can work with sports people. And I can take them through hypnosis and get them to imagine being on the golf on the golfing green and, you know, putting their ball in way better than they've ever done before. And through mental rehearsal, their unconscious mind comes to believe they've done it.
Wow.
And it's more likely then that it ends up that they can do in reality, because the unconscious doesn't know the difference between imagined and reality in the same way as if predictive programming stuff goes in, because it's weird imagery that doesn't make sense. So the conscious mind either sees it as entertainment or gets confused. That means the critical faculty, analytical area of the mind kind of goes, yeah, it makes no sense to me. Can't tell if it's safe or dangerous. It must be fine. It's just entertainment. So when it gets, and it's in your unconscious, subconscious, call it what you will,
where it stays,
to be pattern matched when something relevant to that comes. But when it pattern matches, because it's been delivered in an entertainment form of safety and innocence, allegedly, things that should be picked up as dangerous or red alert are more likely to go under the radar, because when your unconscious subconscious does the pattern matching, it finds something that relates that's got associations of entertainment.
Now, I'm betting you that theory is controversial, I'm guessing. You're an expert, you're a qualified expert, so I have great respect.
There's no such thing as qualified. Let's make that clear. There's no such thing. No, I should say
there isn't. You're qualified to talk is what I meant to say. You're qualified to talk on this subject. So a lot of our listeners will say this is very interesting but very controversial. Surely our conscious and our unconscious minds, it's the same thing, can make a distinction between what is and what isn't real.
The conscious can, the unconscious subconscious can. And this is known in general psychology, you know, not just in conspiracy or truth circles. It's known in conventional psychology, but it's known on a much deeper level by those with nefarious intent. A prime example being, I am one of the few hypnotherapists, stage hypnotists, hypnosis trainers in the world who categorically will go on record and state that you can make anyone say or do anything you want against their morals, against their values and against their will. To do so would be breaking the law, obviously, but it is possible, and under controlled conditions, for the purposes of certain media experiments. You know, in the past, for the Gadget Show on Channel 5, I was set the challenge of, could I get people to reveal their computer passwords to me without their knowledge and against their will? And I did in 2 out of 3 of the times I tried. And if I'd been given a bit longer to work with the third person, I would have cracked it eventually, but there was limited time for the filming.
So that aspect, that
evidence, you can kill people with hypnosis. I was just going to, they know this.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I was just going to say the Manchurian candidate aspect or possibility of that. So you could
trail.
You could do it. Yeah, I believe that.
Well, you definitely can. Yeah, Saran. You know, the Kennedy incident. Of course you can. And the easiest way is to make the person believe they're doing something that doesn't contradict the morals or the values.
Oh, is that how you do it? Is that how you do it? Because I am absolutely certain that I could not be compelled. I'm not saying I disbelieve you. I do believe you. But sitting here right now, I am not a murderer. I would not murder anybody. I think I would have to be at death's door myself, or my family would need to be threatened for me to do anything like that to somebody else. I would have a legitimate legal reason, but I couldn't be
far easier. Far easier.
Yeah,
we'd use regression to make you feel, act, and think as though you were 5 or 6 years of age, and that you were playing cowboys and Indians, for example.
Go on.
And that you are the number one cowboy sheriff in town, and that when you see the red Indian who, and then describe the individual, so John F. Kennedy, describe the individual, yeah. When you see the
Bobby Kennedy,
Indian,
whatever, yeah,
you will see them and react as though they are the big bad Indian, and you need to save the world, so you'll pull out your cap gun from your inside pocket, and you'll go bang, 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 bang with the cap gun 4 or 5 times to make sure that you can, you know, kill the big bad red Indian. And then, you know, the person can basically, you can make the person believe that they're 5, 6 years old doing something in the context of a 5, 6 year old that would be acceptable to them morally because they're just playing. But actually, in this example, obviously, it wouldn't be a cap gun.
It would be a loaded firearm, yeah. And then off you go. No, I've read enough on that particular subject over the years, and
there's a little bit more to it than that, but I'm not going to go into the slightly little bit more on how to do it, because you know,
you might get into trouble. Yeah,
trying it, but let me tell you, MK Ultra investigated the use of trauma-based mind control years ago after the war, when they shipped Josef Mengele over from Nazi Germany secretly into America, and he started doing abhorrent experiments there. And one of the things they learned how to do wonderfully through pain, the use of pain, drugs, yeah, and sexual and physical assault, was to compartmentalize a person's brain. So in other words, to get parts of your brain to splinter off into different personalities. It's how you create multiple personality disorder or split personalities. And you can therefore create a traumatized personality that splinters off, that's totally individual from the person's normal consciousness, that when they're flicked into that altar, as it's called, that traumatized personality state or altar, morals and values can be such that they would happily kill someone if they thought that by killing somebody, it would bring an end to that trauma and abuse that particular personality had been receiving.
Do me a favour, right? I probably should have given more time to this today. Get back on with me within the next 2 weeks to get into more of this, will you, Jonathan? Because it's really important.
By all means, fire a day.
Yeah, we'll do a bit longer. Before Jonathan goes, back to my pal Spiro in the media. He makes an interesting point, though, Spiro, about the Jewish lobby in the United States, Jewish lobby. And again, I'm probably too hard on, I'm not hard on people, when, you know, the term Jewish. I, of course, am completely uncensored. I do not self-censor. Anybody who knows me and knows the abuse that I took from the Zionist lobby in the UK last year, I had people putting my address online, my phone number, because I revile the state of Israel. I hate it. It shouldn't exist. It has no right to exist. It's an apartheid state that brutalizes the indigenous people of that region. And its lobbyists around the world, not to mention Hasbara. I mean, it's a dreadful thing, Israel, and its influence in the US and in the UK. I could talk all day long about that. But not to try and save my own back. I get accused of this all the time. Oh, Richie won't say what he really thinks. No, because it's not what I really think. That's got nothing to do with Jewish people living all over the bloody world. You know, what are they going to do about that? It's got nothing to do with them. But yeah, he wants me to put it to you, the influence of the Jewish lobby in US politics and in UK politics, well, I'm guessing you probably, you accept that it is very, very, what's the word I'm looking for here now, prominent, influential.
Yeah, but it appears to be so because some very rich individuals get publicised because they're out up front. However, in terms of how, you know, the percentage of people involved, it's a teeny weeny tiny number. So you can't really say that because of that obvious prevalence that, you know, that means that there's some kind of conspiracy there.
It's a good way of putting it, Jonathan. You can't. Look, however much I despise Israel, I don't blame Jews for it. The far right for years always blamed Jews. It's the Jews. And I never had any time for any of that. I totally endorse their right to free speech and to believe whatever they want to believe. But I never believed, I never bought into that. I had, as far as I was concerned, I was smarter, too smart for that nonsense. You know, it's got nothing to do with individual people. Israel is Israel. It's done what it's done. And listen, blame France, blame the United Kingdom. Look at the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Look at the Balfour Declaration. Blame the United States of America.
These days, the vast majority of people that are traceable, as in with a bit of research, who are massively millionaires or billionaires, the vast majority are certainly not Jewish.
It's a fact.
So, you know, facts are facts. You can't argue with that if you bother to actually look. So, you know.
Divide and conquer. You said it earlier on, it's divide and conquer. As long as we're killing each other over race, religion, culture, these things happen. This COVID thing happens. And we see a world now emerging, the reset, the fourth industrial revolution. And the idea that any group of people is immune to that, the idea that blacks or Asians or Mexicans, Hispanics or Irish or Jews or Catholics are immune to it. We've killed each other over the years, Muslims against Jews, Jews against Catholics, Catholics against Jews, you know, boxing ourselves into our identity.
They do that on purpose. They want the wars. We cover that in Extreme Danger. I mean, if you go online and type in Google Mindspace document, you'll get the instituteforgovernment.org.uk's website with a PDF called Mindspace, okay? This is from the Cabinet Office, and it's subtitled Influencing Behaviour Through Public Policy. And it tells you, it gives you insights into how they emotionally manipulate the mass populace.
It's a great film, Jonathan. Extreme Danger, Extreme Hypnosis. You can find it on YouTube. Go to Glitch in the Code if you want to watch it. It was premiered on YouTube. It was put up there for free on Sunday. A lot of people watched it. Glad to see that. Great film. We'll talk again real soon. Thanks for your time today. Fascinating insight,
Jonathan.
Thank you, Richie.
Take care. We'll speak soon.
Can't wait, buddy. Bye for now. Terrific. Jonathan Ryle, live on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Very respected clinical hypnotherapist and very successful stage hypnotherapist there, talking about initially why the compliance, why we are bearing witness to this mass compliance to mask wearing, to social distancing, and, you know, even businessmen and women agreeing to close down their businesses. Now, I'm going to be talking to Sandy Edwards in a moment. Before that, the wonderful Mark Bojerski, can't say enough about him, markbojerski.com, did say on this show last week, he said, Richie, I've got a box of healing crystals that I have had for many years, and I'm going to put it up, and when people make a contribution, when they support the program financially, this week we will put their names into a draw and somebody will win it. He's also given me two pendants, so we'll have three winners. I'm going to announce the winners at the end of the program. And I want to say thanks to Mark, because it's raised over £1,000 for the Richie Allen Radio Show, and our expenses these days are significant. So I can't thank him enough for doing that. It's an amazing thing, particularly at this time when people are struggling and they don't have money to support independent media. So thanks to Mark Bojerski for that. I'll announce the winner at the end of the programme. So don't, if you're in, you have a chance to win, right? And there you are. I'm doing it all above board here. We've got Stokes Kennedy Crowley. That's who we have here, keeping an eye on it. Right, Sandy Edwards. What a remarkable woman. Took part in a trial, in a real clinical trial of natural healing in Birmingham four years ago. There's a book about it called Healing in a Hospital, Scientific Evidence that Spiritually Healing Improves Health. And spiritual healing improves health. We'll talk to Sandy about that in a moment. Don't go anywhere. Before We do that, though, a very quick pause. The Richie Allen Show, Tuesday, October 13, 2020.
Renowned healer Mark Bajerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bajerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbajerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Back in a moment with Sandy Edwards, live from Spain on your Richie Allen Show. Right, that is Queen and Crazy Little Thing Called Love on Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Now, Peter Ebdon was on the programme a couple of times, and the first time he was on, he talked a little bit about his own experience and his own healing journey. Peter did, and it was lovely. And I've gotten to know him since, and he said to me, Richie, I'm sending you a book. You have to read it, Richie, and you might not even be aware that this happened. It should have been, you know, it should have been national, international news. He said a lot of people know about it, but a lot of people don't know about it. Check it out, he said. And he sent me the book, Healing in a Hospital, Scientific Evidence That Spiritual Healing Improves Health by Sandy Edwards. And it's remarkable, really. Again, frustration that I didn't know anything about it. It's about a trial funded by the National Lottery, led by the University of Birmingham, but instigated by my guest today. Okay? And it was a 2-year study involving working with hospital patients, a couple of hundred hospital patients who had irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease, which you probably know, or you might not, but you might know. There isn't a cure for either condition, no medical one anyway. And treatments for them are, well, at the best, how do you put it? They're intermittent. They might be inconclusive, maybe, ineffective. So this is an incredible book, not least because the trial took place, but also because of the results. And let's speak to the author of the book. Thrilled that she's agreed to come on the programme, live from Spain this evening, my old stomping ground. Let's say hello to Sandy Edwards. Sandy, you're very welcome to the programme. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Can you hear me all right?
You sound great.
I've got the headset on and I'm not too sure that you'll be able to hear me.
You've got a lovely
mic,
Sandy.
Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you loud and clear. I hope it's likewise.
Yes. I've put the headset on. I don't think it's a good idea. I think I'll take that. I was thinking that might be better. No, here we are. So, can you hear me now?
Just as good. You sound lovely. I know you're in... I won't say where you are. We'll keep that for
I am in Spain, yes.
You are in Spain.
I am in Spain at the moment, yes. You already said it, I might as well agree.
Yeah, look, no, in terms of exact location, lucky you to be in Spain while we're freezing our butts off here in Salford. But anyway,
What a shame.
As well. I was amazed to receive the book. I didn't know anything about this. I should have known as a journalist who reads the papers.
I've been doing my best to get everybody to know.
Yeah.
But it's ever so difficult, you know. It's
What happened, Sandy? Take us back to the very beginning.
Mainstream. Oh, you've gone.
No, I'm there. Sorry. I'm sorry. I was there might be a slight delay on the line, so I'll refrain from butting in. What I wanted to ask you was, tell us the story in your own words. First of all, how you came to healing, and then how that led to this amazing trial. I mean, I can't wait to hear this. How did you get into it?
Well, I have to agree, it is amazing. I have to stand back in awe of how this could ever have occurred. But first of all, I think it's amazing as well that I had absolutely no sign of a healing ability at all. And I was told that it would be good for me to do healing because I had psoriasis. And by giving healing, this lady told me, it would help the psoriasis. So that was what made me look at becoming a healer. And I was pretty hopeless, really, at anything that we were being taught, because everybody else was able to sense the energies and see colours and have sensations of different sorts. And I had absolutely zip, nothing. So I just put my hands where we were taught to, just the different sequence of hand movements. And the people that I practiced on said wonderful things about their experience, and just as much as patients of the people who did have all of the sensitivity to it. So even though, even for many years, I had no sign myself, no tingling, no seeing lights or colours or images or sensations at all, and yet the people I did the healing on sometimes had magnificent things occur to them. So I've had so much feedback all the time. I thought, well, I've got to carry on, And so I trained for 2 years. That's the minimum training period with the Healing Trust. The Healing Trust is a UK-based but international charity. And most of its members used to be, and all of them used to be, I think, volunteers. Nobody charged anything for what they were doing. That's changing now with the way that society is. There's a lot less volunteering generally across the population. But I'm still a volunteer. And I on the way home, yes, from qualifying, I thought, oh, I could apply for a lottery grant to set up a voluntary healing group near home, because the nearest one to me was a couple of junctions, long junctions away on the M6. And I thought, it's better to have as many as you can have. So the more local they are to people, the more chance they'll experience healing. So I applied for a lottery grant and I got it. And that was in 2000, and opened up a voluntary healing group. I managed to get the mayor of Walsall to... Walsall is, for people who don't know the Midlands, it's near Birmingham. So I managed to get the mayor of... Walsall to invite us to his parlour, and sent the newspaper article off to the local ones, and we had tons of people come to that very first opening in November 2000. And 5 years in, there was a lady who came for healing who I hadn't seen before, and I always like to know where people found us from, so that should I come to do any marketing, and I always went for free marketing because we hadn't got the money to pay for anything, and we're all volunteers, overheads for renting the room, donations only was what covered our costs. And so this lady hadn't got on her card. You always have to have a card with the name and contact details. And so for insurance purposes. So I always like to have a note of where they found us from. And that hadn't been filled in by whoever had seen her before. So I asked her, and I was astonished when she told me that it was her consultant at the hospital who'd sent her.
Wow.
And she told me that he'd sent several others already, and he was pleased with what they had reported. So I got his name and details, and I wrote to him. That was at Good Hope Hospital in Sutton, Coldfield, Dr. Sukhdev Singh. And I wrote to him detailing the professional standards that the Healing Trust adheres to. So as members, there's a whole raft of professional standards. And also I mentioned healers who were working in hospitals as paid employees, one of them being Andrew Buxton King at University College London Hospital, and also Ruth Kay in Leeds Hospital, or it's got a name but I can't think, Leeds Hospital. And so also I could have, if I'd have thought of it at the time, mentioned the House of Lords report. When the House of Lords does a report of anything, it's very in-depth. And that was done in 2000, I think. I'd have to look at that. I'd have to look at my book to check dates. but it's in the book anyway.
Yeah.
And they were saying that healing was beneficial. It was shown to be beneficial. Actually, as regards research into healing, out of all of the different complementary therapies that there are, the most has been on spiritual healing. That's just an aside, mentioning that. So I wrote this letter to Dr. Singh, and he responded positively. So I went along and we met, and it took the hospital, I think, 18 months to give the go-ahead. I don't know why. And so maybe because it was new and different. But then I started working in the next room to Dr. Singh. So an ordinary consultation room, no potted palms, ordinary clinical things around and a couch. And the window looked out onto the local burial ground. So not a lot to put you at ease. But when I saw people, Dr. Singh would have already had a consultation with them and maybe suggest to them that they'd like a healing session. So if they said yes, they came the five paces to my room, and in those five paces, I might say something to break the ice, like, have you ever had healing before? And they would invariably, almost invariably, and I saw hundreds, would say no. And I would ask if they'd ever had any complementary therapy before, and almost everybody said no. Almost everybody. It was amazing how few had experienced such a thing. So I do seem to have a way of relaxing people, don't know. But Dr. Singh would see people immediately after the healing session to see what they had to say about it. And some of the responses were startling for him. And other people noticed improvements later on, and when they came for a further consultation months later, they might tell him then about things that they'd noticed. And just a couple of weeks after starting, these people were saying, these are like highly cynical, skeptical people, didn't believe that healing could possibly help them, and yet it did for many of them, and noticeably for some, startlingly so for others. And I thought, all of this information is just drifting into the ethers. It needs to be gathered. So I asked Dr. Singh if I could do an audit, and so he agreed, good idea. So I wrote a questionnaire. I should have done some research as to how you write a questionnaire. But I just thought, well, the things that are important to people is pain relief, maybe. Do they feel stressed? Are their relationships good? Did they sleep well? All of those kind of things. So only about five questions, I think, maybe six. And so I put this questionnaire together, and it was approved by the hospital committee for that. And I set to. And the questionnaires were coming back with all these lovely comments. Also, I gave them a questionnaire, identical one, to take home with them for them to complete a week later. And from those week later ones, you could see that people were still benefiting a week later, and it's only 20 minutes for a healing session. Perfectly able to give a healing session in any situation. Well, I suppose I ought to say what a healing session consists of. Someone can either be sat down or lying down. They don't need to take their shoes off, their coat off, or anything. And then the healer works around them in a set sequence of hand positions without touch or with touch. I like to use touch, but we're taught without. And a couple of months after me starting at the hospital, I started, I think, in the August or September. In the November, the lottery announced research funding for charities and not-for-profit groups whose work would benefit, whose research would benefit the public. And so I found this out from another member of the Healing Trust. I've never heard of her before, not ever heard of her since, but she took the trouble to send me an email to say this was on offer. And so I went in with this news to Dr. Singh, and he by now had seen enough to have the confidence to bring together the University of Birmingham, which is Russell Group University, which is the UK's equivalent of the Ivy League in the States. So this is huge.
Huge.
And yeah, and so he got a top person in there with the credentials for making a really good research trial for this, plenty of experience in this kind of a thing, not spiritual healing, obviously, but in this kind of a thing. And so this research trial was put together. We applied for the money. Now, applying for the money was a huge, intricate thing to do.
Oh, I can imagine.
And so
yeah.
To get all these people from the university and from, it had to be applied for by a charity. Well, the Healing Trust is a charity, but there's no, it's just a two-bit charity, really. I mean, it's not got the credentials for applying for a massive grant that's going to do a massive research. We just do healing.
Was it a bit overwhelming? It sounds like it was a bit overwhelming, that going down.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Dr. Singh is the hero here. He is the hero of the whole story. He brought together the University of Birmingham. He also brought on board Fresh Winds, a medical charity that uses complementary therapies. I don't think they're in operation anymore, actually.
Yeah.
But he brought them forward to be able to do the application. They already used Healing Trust healers in their organisation, so they were confident of the benefit that healing brings. And so also the NHS had to be involved, the primary care trust, the hospital itself, to provide the patients and the space for us to do the healing in. And he brought all these partners together to agree and made the application, hundreds and hundreds of applications that the lottery people had for this. And it was so complicated an application that they provided workshops for people to go to learn what you have to do. So I went on those.
Is that right?
I went on those. I made sure that I knew all the bits and bobs
that is funny.
That you've got to do. Not the clever stuff, because, of course, the research trials are done by clever people who've got PhDs already.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't. So I went to make sure that we ticked all the boxes. And I fed back all that information through Dr. Singh to get to the clever people who are doing the actual nuts and bolts of it. And hundreds of charities applied, and we got the money.
And you got the money.
£5,000.
Now, what? Remind us now, Sandy, what, before you tell us, remind us which, what year this is. We've got Sandy Edwards live on the radio show from Spain. She's the author of Healing in a Hospital, Scientific Evidence that Spiritual Healing Improves Health. This is a vital conversation, this. She's been explaining, Sandy, how she got into healing, her journey into healing, how she ended up working in this hospital in Walsall with Dr. Singh, because at the charity that she was involved in, the healing charity, the consultants at the hospital were sending people to be healed, amazingly. And that's how it began. And
Only one.
Yeah, but still amazing,
consultant.
Though. An amazing thing, yeah. One consultant, yeah. Dr. Singh. So Sandy goes to meet him and gets on very well with him, and she comes in as a volunteer, as a charity worker, and starts working with people if they consent, if they agree to have a session. And many of these people are showing, very many of them are showing great results. So it's mooted then, the idea is mooted that some research, some proper research is done on this, a proper trial of it. And that's where we are now. Sandy's just telling us, or just told us, that they got a grant of just over £200,000 from the lottery. I find it very funny that you had to go to a workshop to learn how to apply for that. That made me giggle. But anyway, here we are. Now, what year is this, Andy? What year is this?
I think, to be honest, the University of Birmingham would have done it with their hands tied behind their backs anyway. But because those workshops were on, I went to them just to make sure and make sure all the boxes were ticked. Anything I learned, I sent back to Dr. Singh for him to send to whoever was necessary for that. But what was the question? I forgot.
Yeah, it was just about, just for the timeline now, what year did this trial begin? Did you get the grant?
2007 rings a bell, that, because the 2007, I think I started work at the hospital, that's right. And it took a year or two to get the lottery funding, because there was a big delay because when we told Fresh Winds about this idea, they didn't want to do what I'd suggested. They wanted to do something of their own. But luckily for us, for me or the Healing Trust, their application didn't hold water. So it got cast aside straight away. And then there was still a second opportunity to send in applications. There had been three opportunities to send in applications. We missed the first one because Fresh Winds did their own, but there was still a second one to go at. The third was cancelled because there were so many brilliant ones in tranche one. So we still had the opportunity to apply, and we managed to get in by the skin of our teeth for the time, for the deadline of this second opportunity. Second wave.
Thank heavens.
And so we got the money too. Yeah. I know, it's just amazing how this all has occurred. Every stage is another an amazement to me. I'll say the word amazed lots of times, you know, during this interview. So the programme itself then was, you've already mentioned that it was for IBS people and for irritable bowel syndrome and IBD. IBD is inflammatory bowel disease. And this is a gastroenterologist consultant that I was working alongside. So, of course, these are gastro patients that are being involved in this research. And 100 were IBS patients. With IBS, they have terrible symptoms. There's nothing much on the table for them medically to help. And yet, when they have investigations in their body, there is absolutely no sign of lesions or anything that could be causing those symptoms, but those symptoms are still very real.
Yeah.
Those people are suffering. And so the medical world believes that it's probably psychological.
Right.
Though the actual symptoms are real. And the inflammatory bowel disease people, and that consists of ulcerative colitis is one group, and Crohn's disease is another. Those are both inflammatory bowel disease problems, and those do have physical issues that they can see with all of the tests that they have, so they know that that's why they're getting the pain and the whatever else they have. They have terrible issues. They can't go out of their home without knowing where the next toilet is.
Yeah.
It does affect every aspect.
I heard, Sandy, I heard the Manchester United football player, former football player Darren Fletcher, talk about this. He suffered with ulcerative colitis, and he described what living with it was like, and it was a dreadful, dreadful experience. You wouldn't wish it on anybody, from what I understand.
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. And ulcerative colitis affects from something like the stomach and downwards, but if it's Crohn's, it's the whole lot from the mouth all the way down. So Crohn's, you would think, must even be worse. And you think, wow, how can these people even live?
Yeah.
How can they manage? Well, they don't. They very often don't. There's, even for IBD, there isn't much on the table to help them medically. And there isn't a one-pill-cures-all. And some of the surgery isn't effective either. It's awful.
Awful. Tell me this now.
And
I'm fascinated.
Know that there isn't, because there is no medical cure, then when you've got a chronic illness, then you get depression come in very often as well, and confidence is taken away. Sorry, you were going to say
no, I can't. I can't imagine that. It's a very good point you make about the mental health of somebody dealing with something like that. What I wanted to ask, so the trial is beginning now. You mentioned that you're working alongside a gastroenterologist. Were you welcome, Sandy? Were you welcome there? Were people happy for you to be there? They were.
Yes.
Lovely.
There were. It was a Wednesday morning clinic at Birmingham. It's a Birmingham hospital, actually, a Birmingham General Hospital in an area called Sutton Coldfield. So it's on the fringe of Birmingham. And there are other consultants working in the same clinic. Dr. Singh was the it was his clinic, and other consultants worked in the clinic with him. And there was some who were open-minded to it, but not really, a little bit. And but Dr. Singh was the main one, and one of the consultants said that he couldn't see why there was any room given for healing, and he couldn't see a place for it.
Fair enough.
Different people had different opinions, but then he hadn't sent any of his patients to me to be able to see what the difference was, if any.
Fair enough. You sound absolutely lovely anyway, and I'm not just saying that. It sounds to me like that was not something that really concerned you. You were happy to be there. You were happy to do the trial.
Yes.
2 years now.
The nurses were wonderful. The staff on the desk, they were wonderful. Everybody was on side. It was lovely. Lovely place to be. And I would still be there, but I moved from Warsaw, where I was living, to the South Coast, so couldn't be done anymore. And one thing and another, I haven't got into doing something regularly where I live now, but we just travel so much.
Would you travel around? We might come back to that. So you are there.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a controlled clinical trial, proper research into does spiritual healing help? Does it assist in the treatment of people and in their recovery? Wonderful for 2 years. And what are we now? We're 28 minutes to the top of the hour. We can go to 7 o'clock here. It's 8 o'clock in the UK. The results.
Right.
The results.
So I haven't even started on the trial.
I know you haven't. We gotta talk about that. Yeah, so talk about the 2 years then.
Talk about
the 2 years. I mean, did it fly by you? I mean, you were working there every Wednesday, you said, working with these people.
Wednesday morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were two groups of people. There was 100 of the irritable bowel syndrome people, IBS, and we were aiming for 100 with ulcerative colitis, but it's not as common. So it turned out we couldn't populate the trial sufficiently with ulcerative colitis. So we had to go back to ethics committee to agree that we could add Crohn's people into it. Every minor change, you have to go back to the ethics committee to agree it. So the inflammatory bowel disease group eventually consisted of about 20 something Crohn's, and the rest of the 100 were ulcerative colitis people. But out of each of those groups, half of them were given the healing treatment straight away, and they had 5 sessions. Each session is 20 minutes. So 5 20-minute sessions, one each week. So 5 weeks, each week they would have a 20-minute session of healing. And at week zero, before they began, they filled in all these questionnaires to see what the baseline was. So everybody, whether they started having the healing or not, they all filled in at week zero their questionnaires. And there were 3 different questionnaires that each person completed. One was MIMOP. So MIMOP is well known. It's my Measure Your Own Performance, I think it is. So each person, no matter what they had the matter, they had this MIMOP questionnaire to fill in. And that is for whether your life has improved by whatever it is you're receiving. So it could be medication or it could be a treatment of anything else. But in this case, obviously, spiritual healing. So the people who began their healing straight away, they were called the treatment group. And the other group, the ones that were randomized into being the control group, they had to wait for 3 months before they could start having their healing sessions. So that we've got the first 12 weeks to be able to compare the ones who had the healing and the ones that didn't. So there were 50% of the IBS people began straight away with their healing sessions, and 50% of the IBS people waited for 3 months. And then they had their 5 healing sessions. And the inflammatory bowel disease people, they were split. Ulcerative colitis, 50% started straight away. The others waited 3 months. Also the same for the Crohn's. And everybody, though, no matter what they had the matter with them, they all filled in a MIMOP. This was developed by a GP who wanted to know that the treatment she was giving anyone was actually helping their life. It wasn't focused on the actual symptoms for the thing that we're looking at. So it doesn't necessarily reflect how it improved their IBS or their Crohn's. People have other problems as well. Some of these people have a file 2 inches thick of what's the matter with them. I won't go into the details, but it could be something worse than IBS or IBD that's the problem with them. So it's their quality of life that we're looking to see. That was the main point of the whole program, for quality of life. So the main, so this MIMOT then, whatever the score is for the group, each group, a reduction of 1 point is what we're looking for to show that they had tangible improvements to the quality of their life. So after 6 weeks, the IBS and the IBD group that started with their healing session straight away, they went down by a whole point in 6 weeks. So straight after the five healing sessions, you got a questionnaire at week six, straight after your last healing session. Then another one at week 12 to see if the improvements continued. And then at week 24 to see if there was any long-term benefit. So after 6 weeks, they'd gone down by one whole point. That is really good.
Amazing.
And so then week 12, they had the questionnaires again. And the same improvement for both groups again, not a whole point this time. They hadn't had a healing session since week six, wasn't it? Week six was their last healing session. And now it's week 12. So it's week six, could be 7 weeks after their last healing session, I think it is how it works out. So they went down by a further half a point, I think it is. I can't see now the detail on my thing, but they went down again by whatever it was. I would think it's like a quarter point that they went down by, not having had any more healing sessions in that time, but they still improved. And then week 24, they did lose a bit of that benefit, but they still didn't go back up to where, they were. Not at all.
Yeah.
So they still went back up to 1 point improvement, which is clinically determinable for them. There's no getting away from the fact that they did improve. And I'll go on to the next thing, because I'm getting into too much detail and we'll get less. There are three ways of it.
No, I was just going to say the detail is
measuring improvement.
Sorry, Sandy. The detail is it is pretty heavy. It's important.
Yeah.
It's important.
I've got a graph in front of me.
It's important at the same time. But if we can synopsize that as best as we can, because it's really the conclusions that are irrefutable. It's what's astonished me reading the book. Really, you have when these results are coming out, what's the reaction of? I mean, I'm guessing Dr. Singh is not surprised at all, but some of the other clinical men and women, you know, some of the other hospital on not consultants. Have we lost? We've lost her just briefly. Hang on, there, we'll get her back. This is just getting really, really good. Sandy Edwards is our guest. Sandy is in Spain. She is the woman behind a book called Healing in a Hospital, Scientific Evidence to Spiritual Healing Improves Health. And it's about an astonishing 2-year clinical trial involving 200 hospital patients with long-standing illnesses. We mentioned them, irritable bowel syndrome being one of them, and ulcerative colitis. And the results, this was national lottery funding. The University of Birmingham is involved. Let's get Sandy back to call. It does happen when you're on these, even in 2020, these long-distance calls, you know. So we'll get her back on the line there. Peter Rebden gave me the book. I didn't know anything about this. It wasn't given a lot of coverage in the national media. Maybe you won't be surprised by that. Sandy, I don't know what happened there, but thank God you're back.
No.
I lost you
momentarily. I looked at my phone and it said no service, so something must have happened to the
signal. Well, thank God you're back, because we're getting to the crux of this now. I was asking you about the reaction of the other clinicians when these results were coming out.
I don't know.
No?
I don't know, really. It took a long while for the results to come out, and I'm not sure if I was still even in the Midlands then, because I moved 7 years ago. And so I can't remember what the reactions were within the hospital. It took a long time for the research papers to get published, because that was another issue that you want to get to the biggest and the best of the medical journals to get it out into peer-reviewed journals. And it's only when it comes out in a medical journal that you can talk about it at all. So it's like having a jury at a trial, a criminal trial. You can't have the information out in the public that the jury's got to make a decision on. So that's the same way with research. You can't discuss it before it's out in the public,
it's out there,
in a journal, medical journal. And so there were two research papers that came out of it. There's the one where it's the questionnaires. So that's the quantitative.
Yeah.
And then there's the qualitative paper. So two research papers came out, and they reflect each other's results. So that's another confirmation. But there's confirmation of those results as well by statistical significance, because that was incredible. And also, what's the other one? Effect size. Effect sizes means that it did actually make a positive effect for the patient. More detail about that. But the thing is that each one of those questionnaires reflected the benefits of the others. So you could tell that it isn't a fluke. It's been reconfirmed by the three different questionnaires. And also, when the groups that had to wait for 3 months started their healing sessions, they followed the same level of improvement as the first groups. So that was a double confirmation.
The results are irrefutable. That's the thing. That's the thing that staggered me.
They are.
They're irrefutable. And you've got medical professionals saying that this could basically change the NHS overnight in terms of funding, in terms of money, in terms of saving money, in terms of approaching, you know, the treatment of people with long-term debilitating conditions. It's a staggering thing. I don't mean I'm staggered because I wouldn't have believed it. I mean, it's not that at all. I would have believed it. But the fact that it happened for 2 years, that you were there every Wednesday morning, that you had the University of Birmingham, you had serious medical people looking at it, and they concluded, not only did they conclude that this is hugely beneficial, but they also threw out the door the notion that it's a placebo. That's completely not even on the table, because many of these people were, you know, not in any way expecting it to work. And I've had a question for you from a number of people. Mm. One of the questions is, when we say spiritual healing, does that mean that there are prayers involved or some acknowledgement of the divine? It doesn't.
No.
That's what I thought.
I think there would be acknowledgement that there's something greater than us happening somewhere. But all religions and none are reflected in the membership of the Healing Trust. It's not a religious organisation at all. Nothing at all to do with any religion. But the people in, I mean, I know Jews and Christians and Islamic and Hindu. Oh, no, actually, I said Islamic and I'm not too sure on that one. But definitely Hindu and Buddhist and anything you can think of, really. And people who don't believe in any religion and get cross about it are healers as well. And everybody is a healer, no matter what they believe they really are. Everybody is. If I can do this, anybody can do it.
Now tell me this, Andy. That's one of the fascinating things about your story, is that you didn't have any signs of having any ability before, you know, before this. Couple of questions that are really, really important questions, obviously. So here you have this peer-reviewed clinical trial. It's as scientific as it gets. It states unequivocally this works. It does work, right? Yeah. And it could be huge. So the obvious thing is, why wasn't it huge? What happened afterwards?
Because
go on.
There was a newspaper. There was a newspaper, Mail on Sunday, actually, that did a horrible article in the newspaper, because one of the people who was approached for being involved in the trial was aghast that money would be wasted on this, and that healing would be happening in a hospital, spiritual healing would be happening in a hospital. And so she took it to the newspapers, and they did an awful article. And so when it came to fruition and now the results were out, I went to the same newspaper and they wouldn't print anything.
Imagine.
So actually the main man, what do you call that, the main editor,
the editor,
he was
yeah.
happy, but the people who did the health pages, they said no. And so then I went to the actual reporter who did this explosive item.
A hit piece, we call it.
He couldn't get me off the phone quick enough. And so, no, I've had nothing. But thank goodness for Peter Edden. He did the world champion snooker player who mentioned it on Radio 5 Live.
He did, yeah.
Because as a result of him doing that, his controversial views were mentioned in the Sunday Times and the Telegraph, and they did mention my book as well, so that was good. And, oh, I have to also tell you that I was invited a few years ago by the All-Party Parliamentary Committee for Integrated Health to give the presentation of these results in the Houses of Parliament.
Yeah.
So that was... That was hopeful of developments, but I've heard nothing since.
See, actually. This is the thing, you see, because I can understand why the media did a hit piece on the trial. That's what the Daily Mail does. That's what the tabloids do. What I can't understand is why the results didn't send shockwaves up and down the corridors of the National Health Service itself. Why weren't doctors...
I know.
Why didn't they say, listen, this is great, why aren't we doing more of this, you know?
I don't know. I cannot understand it. I cannot understand it. And I do say in my book that this could be helpful. I mean, it's taxpayers who pay for the NHS. All of it is taxpayers' money. And so it would benefit taxpayers and the NHS. But most importantly, those people who are suffering. We can all benefit from healing. No, nobody is in a perfect shape. All of us have got issues of some sort, and all of us can benefit from healing. And it's why aren't we making more of it? I don't understand.
I don't know the answer to that now, Sandy. I would, if I was offered the opportunity to hazard a guess, I would imagine, and you don't have to be you don't have to be Albert Einstein, you don't have to be the smartest man or woman in the world to know there are very powerful lobby groups. Very powerful lobby groups that sell medicines for everything. They're inventing medicines other day of the week, and they don't need to hear this. You know, if you're big pharmaceutical companies, you don't need to hear of wonderful women and men whom are doing things like healing people, spiritually healing people. Well, there's no money in that for them. None.
No, I know. Because this is one big issue. But I think pharmaceuticals are great. I would go straight to the cupboard for painkillers myself. But I think have the two together. And that's what this trial was about, because these people continued with their conventional health care. Many of them had been suffering for years. Since diagnosis, the minimum that anybody on this trial had been diagnosed was a year and a half. And when people have conditions like these, they don't go to the doctor straight away.
Yeah.
They suffer in silence for ages, see what they can do on their own. It's too embarrassing. And so eventually they do go to the doctor, then they get sent to a consultant. So it's a long while before they're even diagnosed. And one of the people on it, I think the longest anybody had been diagnosed was 10 and a half years. I think you probably... Have you read my book now? Did you see the story of the guy with ulcerative colitis who doesn't have it anymore?
Who doesn't have it anymore, completely gone. Yeah.
Totally not present in his body.
Yeah.
And he had 5 sessions on the trial with me. There were 3 different healers giving healing on the trial, and there were backup healers for if any of us couldn't make our sessions. And this one particular guy there, he had all 5 sessions with me, and after the whole trial had finished, by chance, he had another 5 with me just whenever he went to see Dr. Singh. And he came to a certain age where he was he had things in the post to check the colon. And something occurred that was unusual. So he was feeling much better. He knew that he was feeling better. But he went for the tests, and through that test, they realised that there wasn't anything actually the matter. And they said, by the way, there's no sign of ulcerative colitis in here. So you mustn't have ever had it, they thought.
Nonsense.
But he definitely did.
He definitely did have it.
Because it's something you expect to live with forever, because there isn't anything that cures.
That's what they still say to this day. Let me ask you this. I've been dying to ask you this for the last 40 minutes. Have you started to see, have you started to see colours, and have you had the tingling in your hands? Did that
oh,
ever?
Oh, yes.
Of course.
I don't generally see colours or have, I do have sometimes images, but it's never anything that divulges any personal information of the person. I never need to know anything but their name and their phone is for insurance, you know, whatever details I need for insurance purposes. I don't need to know anything at all about them, and that suits me fine. I don't need them to go through their pain to tell me their painful story. I don't need to be bogged down with that. I just do the healing. That's all we're there trained to do, is to deliver the healing energy. And it knows better than me. I just do the healing process and wait and see what happens.
Do you know what?
And luckily... Pardon?
No, I was just going to say, speaking of that, I love when you went to a nursing conference and you met a load of nurses that were curious enough to say, all right, Sandy, I'll have a session. And the comments from the nurses after having a session with you, well, they're just remarkable. They make remarkable reading, you know.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Amazing.
And they were all sceptical, every one of them, and there's hundreds of them. We went to the Nursing in Practice exhibition
at the NEC.
I took a team there each year for as long as we could do it. And then it was astonishing. And they loved it. The nurses were either nurses or staff from GP's surgery very often.
It was an amazing read.
Yes, it was amazing.
Sandy, I've loved...
Also, some other bits of... Go on.
No, you finish that sentence. Go on.
Okay. I wanted to tell you as well that there's a filmmaker, a British filmmaker called Dina Barnett, who's filmed everything she needs to film for completing a film about spiritual healing called Spiritual Healing, A New Frontier in Medicine. And I'm on that. That's why I'm mentioning it, of course, so that you can look out for that one day. I don't know when that's coming out. But then also a German filmmaker came over and he has interviewed 20 different people, mostly in Germany, but Rupert Sheldrake from Britain, you may have heard of.
Yeah, yeah.
And he interviewed me as well, so that was amazing. And unusually, it seems to us in England, Britain, that people in Germany are prepared to pay cinema tickets to go and see a feature film documentary about healing.
Wow.
So that is currently now in cinemas in Germany,
is it? Oh, we'll have to see it when it comes out.
Maybe that will be converted to other languages. I don't know.
Well, do you know what, Sandy? Go on. I don't want to, because we're rapidly running out of time. That's why I'm just jumping in there. So if there's something else you want to mention,
give it
a mention. Yeah.
So now I've got a publishing deal with a German company, and so it's all in German and selling well in Germany. And on the strength of that, fantastic, I've got a worldwide proper publishing deal now, and the second edition will come out in September next year.
Brilliant. I want to thank you for coming on. Folks, you've actually been listening to a lady called Sandy Edwards. You've actually been listening to somebody who took part in a clinical trial backed by the National Lottery, run by university academics and doctors, that concluded after 2 years that spiritual healing is real, it works, and it could do extraordinary things for people if it was embraced by the government and the NHS. The book, and I insist that you go online and find it, is Healing in a Hospital by Sandy Edwards. Buy a copy of it. It's absolutely fantastic. After my missus reads it, Peter sent it to me.
Yeah.
I'm going to send it to the west of Ireland, to my mate Jean Ann in Cleggan. It's some read, Sandy, and you are some astonishing woman. Come back anytime you want to talk more about this. No,
well,
I do mean that.
The astonishing thing is that all this happened.
It happened, I know.
Magical.
I know, and we should have heard more about it through the media, and the NHS should have taken it and ran with it, but we could speculate again all day long. It's a brilliant book, and you're a great person to... I've gone through that and lived through that, Sandy. Yeah, you're amazing. Come back anytime you want.
Thank you.
And thanks to Peter Ribden as well. Top man. And thanks to Peter Ribden as well. Top bloke.
That was lovely of him.
Cheers, Sandy. Wasn't that lovely? Sandy Edwards, live from Spain. Mad stuff to be reading that when I was sent that by Peter. You're actually, you know, it's kind of frustrating to hear about that and not to realise that it went on, that it happened. But the biggest trial of its kind in the world, one of anyway, certainly the biggest in this country. Clinical conditions, properly controlled conditions. A trial produced papers that said, this works. This woman knew what she was doing. And these people that were part of the trial, the subjects, their lives changed immeasurably. Their sicknesses went away. Their lives became more manageable. Amazing stuff. Great. Thanks to Sandy. Now, let's go out on a really, if that was positive, this is just as positive as well. My pal, Mark Bajerski. Check out markbajerski.com. A healer himself of great repute, great renown, has been very helpful to me over the years and some people very close to me. Mark put together a collection of healing objects, of crystals, important to him, a box, really. I said artifacts like an idiot the other day, they're not artifacts, but a lovely collection. And he said, Richie, when people send a few bob to the programme, when they support it, they don't donate because this isn't a charity. I work 80 hours a week, there's no charity here. When they support the programme, they will go into the draw. And we have winners. Now, there's three prizes. So we have a winner of the big prize, the box, of course. And then he said, Richie, I'll have two pendants as well. So you can give a pendant for two runners up. And I've got the names here. All above board, of course. And none of these people are known to me, nor are they known to Mark. That's how it should be. And the winner of the overall... The big collection of crystals and healing objects is Joanne Martin in Leicester. Well done, Joanne. I've got Joanne's details. I sent them to Mark. I've got her address. So well done. Joanne wins the overall prize, Joanne Martin. And thanks for supporting the Richie Allen Radio Show. And the winners of the pendant, we've got David Hall in Cornwall. David Hall, how you doing, David? You will receive a pendant from Mark. He has your address. And another pendant winner is Joanna C. Morgan. Joanna C. Morgan. But I don't have an address for Joanna. She made her contribution to the show and it was just her email address. So the overall winner then, Joanne Martin. Well done, Joanne. The pendant winners, David Hall and Joanna C. Morgan. And Mark Bajerski has the details. And sincere thanks to him. I can't thank him enough for his support, not only of this programme, but also the independent media. It's markbajerski.com. Thank you, Mark. Lovely. I love you for it. Thank you. Thanks again to Jonathan Royal. Thanks, Jonathan. And to the lovely Sandy Edwards. That was Tuesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. Live from Salford. I'll speak to you tomorrow at 5. Until then, you look after yourselves. As I said, have a good rest of your Tuesday evening or Tuesday day, wherever you are. Bye for now. Bye now. We have all